Morning.
Morning.
Keeping the Sabbath, keeping the Lord's Day holy. Growing up in the Catholic Church, in St. Catharines for the most part, attending Sardisi Parish in Port Dalhousie, I was taught to believe that it was a sin to miss Mass on Sunday. It was taught as a major sin, a mortal sin. In other words, it was something that put your soul at risk of eternal punishment if you didn't go to Mass on Sunday. It wasn't just that you were expected to go to church. You had to go to church, point of view. There were some exceptions to that absolute requirement. If you were ill, for example, then it was understood that you couldn't make it to Mass. Or if you're in some other kind of situation that made it impossible for you to get to Mass, then there was a bit of a mercy shown, I guess. But you were to keep the Lord's Day holy. And that meant going to Mass if you're able, and if possible, taking communion. Because quite frankly, the entire Mass is built around this ritual of transforming the bread and wine into the body and blood of Christ and offering this channel of grace to the faithful. Now, I haven't been an active member of the Catholic Church for some 50-odd years. And while at one time I probably knew why it was so important to be at Mass on Sunday morning, I wasn't sure anymore, so I thought it might be appropriate to check out the Catholic Church's position online. So in the last couple of days, I've been going online and looking for Catholic websites to give me some insight. I wanted to confirm whether obligatory attendance is still the case, and if so, to find an explanation of why that might be so. So I came upon a site that I think is probably as reliable as any other. And according to this site, the Church, yes, does still consider attendance at Mass to be an essential component of life. It's not optional. But to quote the site in question, "In this age of Catholic laxity, many have lost sight of the fact that it is a grave, i.e. mortal sin, to skip Mass on Sunday or Holy Day of obligation when one is able to attend." The site then goes on to explain why it's important, even necessary, to attend Mass, to go to church. It describes the experiences of the early Christian church under Roman state persecution and the risk of death run by early Christians if they were identified as Christians and if they refused to abandon their faith. If they recanted and said, "No, I abandon this faith," then they were spared death at least. They may have been sent off to the mines, but they weren't killed. But according to the site, it says, for about 250 years, from Nero to Constantine, so 64 AD to 312 AD thereabouts, taking part in Eucharistic worship was a crime punishable by death. It is true that official persecution of Christians by the state was intermittent. There were periods when the state was preoccupied with other things, and periods when local authorities simply chose to ignore the Christians' existence, but always a Christian's being apprehended at worship was a capital crime. During the times when the law against Christian worship was not being enforced, a Christian still might be martyred if someone accused him of being a Christian and he refused to deny it. And the site then gives some examples of individuals who found themselves in that situation. Then goes on to say that the Roman government really had little concern about individual Christian believers. It focused its attack on Christians expressing their belief in corporate worship. When a Christian lapsed under the threat of death, the state probably didn't care whether or not he was sincere. The state knew that apostasy would exclude that Christian from the assembly, and it was the assembly itself that was always the primary target of persecution. I suppose because the congregation or the assembly on a couple of fronts would have been seen as a threat to the Roman state. One, it was a direct challenge against the idea that the Caesar, the emperor, was a god. But it was also a direct challenge to the authority of that state and this group of people who held to a different kind of authority. The site then goes on to say that ironically the church and the state were agreed on one point. The basic test for determining if a person were Christian was whether that person shared regularly in the church's worship. For the state, A person who professed Christian beliefs but did not express them in worship posed no danger. For the church, beliefs not expressed in regular Eucharistic worship were meaningless. State and church were at odds, of course, on the significance of public worship. The state regarded sharing in the Christian assembly as an act of treason, a capital crime. The church regarded sharing in its worship as the supreme positive affirmation before God of the Christian life. Now, this site clearly equates the worship services of the early church with the understanding of the nature of the Eucharistic and current Catholic thought, Catholic theology, an occasion to participate in the transformation of the bread and wine into the literal body and blood of Christ. It then asks and answers the question, what impelled those Christians to risk their lives regularly by sharing in the Eucharist? And it says that they were convinced that only in this corporate action could each Christian receive the fulfillment of his being as a member of Christ's body. They believed with all their hearts that in the Eucharistic action, as in no other way, each person could take his part in that act of sacrificial obedience to the will of God, which was consummated on Calvary and which had redeemed the world, including himself, the individual. So for the Catholic, then, participation in worship on Sunday, and specifically taking communion, is the way that we ensure we are connected to God and the way we maintain our membership in the body of Christ. And I suppose growing up in the Mennonite church, it would have been much the same, I would think. You were expected to go to church on Sunday. And if you didn't, there were probably question marks around the strength of your faith or your commitment to the faith. Missing church may not have been seen perhaps as a sin, per se, and certainly not as a mortal sin. But I suppose it would have been viewed as a flagrant disregard of Paul's encouragement in Hebrews to not neglect the gathering together for worship and mutual support on the Lord's Day. And if most Mennonite churches of 40 or 50 years ago were anything like the evangelical churches I was introduced to as a young adult, there may also have been an expectation that you shouldn't work on Sundays. You should keep the day holy. And there may even have been some lingering sense of guilt around the idea of going out for church for lunch after church, because it meant that someone else had to work on Sunday, and it may have felt a little hypocritical to impose this on someone else if you were not willing to work on Sunday. Not sure if that's ever been an issue here at MFM, any lingering sense of guilt about going out for lunch after church. So what does it mean to keep the Lord's Day holy? What does it mean to observe the Sabbath? Both passages that were read, the one from Isaiah and the one from Luke, address this to some extent. But the passage that was read from Luke's Gospel, the healing of a woman in the synagogue on the Sabbath, is one of those passages that I think underlines the extent to which Jesus' ministry was so radically or was so radical in the way that it challenged the religious structures and the observances and practices of the day. I think it highlights our very human tendency to kind of fall into patterns of behavior that on the surface appear to respect what's expected of us, while at the same time totally missing the point of why we're expected to behave in a particular way. And I think Jesus is also modeling in a very direct way, in a very personal way, the same point that Isaiah makes in the passage that was read from chapter 58. That is, that God expects you to observe the Sabbath. But God is more interested in how observing the Sabbath affects your life. God expects your observance of the Sabbath to enrich your ability and your willingness to take care of those in need and to live out your own love for God. And in this particular case of this healing of this woman in the synagogue, I think it should be pointed out that Jesus isn't challenging the act of gathering for worship on the Sabbath. He's not challenging the main structure of Jewish life and religious behavior. From what we're told in the Gospel accounts, he's a frequent and I assume a regular participant in Sabbath worship. He's asked to preach on multiple occasions. So he observes the Sabbath. He just doesn't seem to feel the need to pattern himself after a particular way of observing the Sabbath. He's challenging instead, I think, the rigid adherence to a set of instructions around how to observe the Sabbath and keep the Lord's Day holy. And that's maybe pretty obvious. I'm sure you've all heard many sermons along that line. He's challenging here, as he does elsewhere, the idea that observation of the Sabbath is a limiting factor in our embrace of life. And he famously states, as you know elsewhere, that the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. In other words, I think he's challenging the idea that our love of God and our love of our neighbor are in competition. He's challenging that idea. The idea that being faithful to one obligation of loving God sometimes may exclude being faithful to the other obligation of loving our neighbor. And I think that's exactly what's happening in this healing of this crippled woman. And perhaps he's even suggesting, in this act of healing a woman in the synagogue on the Sabbath, that living out our love to our neighbor is never in conflict with living out our love to God, even when the demonstration of that love of our neighbor conflicts with what we perceive to be correct religious observance. Maybe he's trying to drive home the point that the seemingly pious observance of religious orthodoxy, when that apparent piety allows us to avoid responding to the needs of our neighbor, is in fact not honoring God and not in keeping with the spirit of compassion and mercy that is behind the institution of the Sabbath in the first place. And that said, I think there's also very much an argument to be made that observing the Sabbath by worshiping with others of like faith is an important part of equipping ourselves to live out both our love of God and our love of our neighbor. I obviously no longer believe that attending a Catholic Mass is essential to my salvation. I no longer believe that I'm putting myself in mortal sin or mortal danger by occasionally missing church on a Sunday for some reason, some legitimate reason. But I'd like to end this meditation by quoting once again the website that I consulted on Matters Catholic. And the site says this: "The utter folly of what we do by willfully ignoring our Mass obligation is somewhat analogous to a deep-sea diver's putting a crimp in his airline so that no air can come through to keep him alive. By a decision to miss Mass or a holy day of obligation, we suspend the operation of sanctifying grace in our lives. For the sake of our eternal salvation, we must go to confession in true contrition as soon as possible and take the crimp out of our airline, so to speak, allowing sanctifying grace again to flood our souls." I like this analogy of a crimped airline cutting off the oxygen that we need to live. I like the image of Sunday worship as an occasion to draw in the fresh air of encouragement that we get from each other as we gather together on a Sunday morning. I like the idea that sharing our worship of God in this way is a way of regenerating our faith and strengthening the bonds that hold us together as a community. And I very much like the idea that our love of thy neighbor is never in conflict with the love of God.